Okay, hi everyone. Hola. Welcome to a small series myself, Rabbi Zalman, put together. And we are going to be going through various life cycle events and different questions and thoughts, 45 minutes. And tonight's class is going to be birth. Not that I'm giving birth, but I'm just speaking about it. Bris Mila, I'm definitely not doing that again. And names. And how we choose names, why we choose names, and what's up with Hebrew names. We're going to begin with the first mitzvah in the Torah. Number one of 613. Does anybody know what the first mitzvah in the Torah is?
Procreate.
Thank you so much for offering, but yes, it is. Notice, however, before the mitzvah to procreate is mentioned, it does say there has to be a coming together of male and female. Let me read the verse with you in the English so we get a feel of what's going on, and then we'll see how this idea of bringing children into the world is connected to the idea of a synthesis between a male and female. And God said, let us make man in our image, B'Tselem Elokim, after our likeness. By the way, this is not a physical image. The commentators say different opinions. One opinion is that we have free will. Just like God, as it were, has free will to do what God wants, so too we humans, unlike animals, are bestowed with the power of Bechira, which is free will. It then says we have to rule over the sea and the animals. So God created man in his image, B'Tselem Elokim. We have the ability to emulate God. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. The original form of humans were male and female fused together. And God blessed them. We're in the book of Genesis, by the way. Verse 1, chapter 20, verse 28. God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Okay, now different opinions what the verse is saying. One opinion is that it's a blessing with which God put upon the world, that we would have the ability to multiply. Without a blessing from God, it wouldn't happen. And another opinion is, this is obviously speaking, God speaking to Adam and Eve, or whoso would become Adam and Eve, actually. He was actually giving them the first mitzvah. And there is a mitzvah to find your soulmate, which is not tonight's class. And once you do, the real mitzvah of marriage is there in order for us to bring life into this world. That's what it's about. Now, this is a very unusual thing, because animals have kids. We see dogs have kids, and cats have kids, and mice, and rabbits have lots of kids. So what exactly is the difference between man and animal over here? And to answer this, I would like to tell you a little story, which I think summarizes this concept quite succinctly, which is going to be tonight's idea. My friend, I've told the story before, at reunion, my friend was flying from, I think it was from London to Israel at the time, and he had, I think, maybe four or five kids at that time. And the kids were scattered around the cabin in different places. And he was sitting next to some guy, an Israeli probably. And they were schmoozing, as you do on a plane. You suddenly talk to strangers you never talk to normally. Unusual experience. And he's schmoozing with this guy. And during the flight, his little children would come to the seat to ask him for stuff. So it was one kid, then the other kid, then another kid. It looked like he had 14 children. It was actually the same kid visiting twice for candy, drinks, or whatever. And they got into a conversation about getting married and having kids. And the Israeli guy sitting next to my friend at the time said, I am married, but I don't have kids. Do you want to know why? So my friend said to him, if you want to tell me, I do. And he said, I'll tell you why. Because we live in a really cruel world. This is not a nice world to live in. It would be wrong, morally derelict, to bring a life into this world. And my friend thought about that and gave the following response. He said, you're right. It is a very cruel, difficult world, but I'm going to bring kids into this world to make this world a better place. And I tell you that story because it really summarizes a very famous commentary called the Sefer HaChinuch, who says that we're not like animals who just have kids to populate the world. We're not here just to add bodies. There's enough people. However, the Jewish concept is that we want to be metakin the olam, to fix the world. And to do that, you need to bring life into the world. But that life has to be nurtured. Its nature has to be nurtured to make that world better. Because the world will not get better unless there are great people to make it great. So our job as parents to create life, and by the way, we are partners in creation. There are three partners in creation, says the Talmud. There is the mommy and daddy that brings the physical body into the world, and there is God that puts the soul into that baby. So we become partners with God in creating the world. And that is a very powerful and unique power that we have to improve the world that is around us. And I think that summarizes what exactly we as humans are after. Marriage is there. And by the way, I've got to mention dating. Those who know me knows I have to mention it. When you are dating, something you need to discuss at some point, earlier rather than later, and I'll tell you some tragic stories if you want to hear them afterwards, of people who don't discuss the idea of having kids. I know people who date for 2-3 years, and suddenly it comes up in conversation. Not date one. I don't want to walk in, hi, nice to meet you, I want babies. Courtney, that's not a good idea. Date 3 is okay. So, do you see yourself having children? Now, you can say, I don't mean with me, I'm just talking theoretically. I'm not offering myself to be the bearer of your children, but to bring it up. So I knew a couple dating for 2-3 years. And after 2-3 years, she said, oh, you know, I want to have kids. He's like, kids, no, another 5 years for that. That could be a bit of a red flag or deal breaker. Okay? So that's worth discussing. And that is the mitzvah to have children. And once again, the idea is not just to populate the world, it's to make the world a better place. We're going to come back to that. Because having children is very much connected to what we do with them when they come out. And one of the first things we do with our children when they arrive, by the way, what is the first thing you're meant to do when you have a child? Well, if you're a woman, it's like, breathe, right? And be very grateful this thing came out of you after 9 months of schlepping it around. But something very interesting, there's a mitzvah, which is recorded in the books, which we do, is as soon as the baby comes out, you make a blessing. You make a blessing of gratitude to God. And if you have a boy, you make one kind of bracha, blessing. And if you have a girl, you have another. So the first thing we do when life comes out, and it's healthy, is you thank God. That's a very powerful thing. And there is a custom for women, although at that point maybe she's not ready, but later on, after the baby's born, she goes to the synagogue, or she gets a group of people around her, and she makes that blessing and gets an amen to it. So it's almost as though the whole focus of this experience is gratitude to God, and we get God involved as soon as possible. And I want to just add something else, since we're on this topic of having children. There is no holier thing that a person can do in Judaism than bring life into this world. As I mentioned, you look at other religions and you can't help but notice that the highest level you can reach is become a priest. And the priest is always celibate, or the guru. Or you look at all these Eastern religions and you look at Christianity, right? The priest, the bishop, the pope. Of course he's calm and happy and smiling. He doesn't have to deal with any kids. In Judaism, it's the exact opposite. The greatest thing you can do, for the reason we just stated, is to bring life into this world. And to work hard at it. And it is a challenge. It goes back to the Garden of Eden. We know that the consequence of what Adam and Eve did in Garden of Eden, means that there was going to be struggles with giving birth, and by the way, not only that, with bringing up children. Built into the system, it is a challenge. And it's also expensive. I read recently, what does it cost to bring up a child? For your average American kid, maybe here on the East Coast, I'm not sure, I don't see any different anywhere else in America, but just to get them to college age, forget college, just college age, how much do you think it costs? If you like throw everything in, it's like 300 grand. And that puts you off having kids right there. It's like, whoa, where's the vacations? And that's possibly with public school. Send them to Jewish day school, you're paying a little bit as well. But that's a wonderful thing. Interestingly enough, since we just passed Rosh Hashanah, I will mention, according to Judaism, the education of your children, spiritually speaking, is not part of your income. As it were, God takes the bill, and you will be given extra income just to take care of that. Okay. Whatever that means, it means, that's what the commentators say. So that's what we do. The baby comes out, and we make a blessing. Any questions on anything I just said? Okay, so what's the first thing we're going to do? Well, it depends if you have a boy or a girl. If you have a girl, there are various customs. One custom is to name that baby girl the first time the father goes to shul to get an aliyah. An aliyah means to go up to the Torah, and that can happen on a Monday, or a Thursday, or a Shabbat. Okay. Whatever comes first, that is the custom. So if a woman gives birth on a Tuesday, that means the husband will go to synagogue on a Thursday, he'll get called up to the Torah, and he will name that child. Different names we're going to speak about later, I'm just on the birth side right now. And the baby girl is named then. Another custom is to wait till the first Shabbat. That is actually my custom. Sephardim probably do that. They wait for the first Shabbat, get called up to the Torah, and everyone makes a big noise and sings and everything, and wishes Mazel Tov. And another custom, which I believe Hasidim do, I believe, is they wait 30 days. And after 30 days, he goes and gets a knife. The idea of 30 days is after 30 days, the baby is considered to be a healthy enough child that it's going to last. For 30 days, we're all a little bit nervous. Baby's not going to survive, although nowadays, thank God they do. But maybe going back a little bit. So the custom is 30 days, Shloshim Yoim, 30 days. Abba goes, gets called on the Torah, and names the child. We're going to come back to names a little bit later. I want to go to Bris Milah, which is going to be the bulk of what we're going to talk about today. Because the Bris Milah, right, the Brit, as we call it, not British, right? But the Brit that we give the child really is a very important and powerful mitzvah. So much so, which if you think about it, even the most secular Jewish person with no Jewish background who doesn't keep anything. I mean, I know people who don't even keep Yom Kippur, but have a baby boy, gotta give him a circumcision. So let's have a look what that mitzvah is about, and we'll see it is connected to everything we've said so far in terms of the importance and the power of having children. Because it's all one. It's all one. So let's go back a little bit. Does anyone know the first person who had a circumcision, a Brit Milah, in the Torah? Who was that? Anybody know? It was Avraham Avinu, Abraham. According to the Muslims, Ibrahim. I won't mention that because it's going to be pertinent a little bit later. Abraham. How old was Abraham when he had his Bris Milah? Wasn't 40. 60. Up. I think he'd be 100 years old. Ooh, makes your eyes water a little bit. When Abraham was visited by those angels in his tent. Remember that story? His tent was open on all four sides. Just like a chuppah is open on all four sides. Right, the chuppah represents the Jewish home, right? That all guests are going to come in. So too, the chuppah is open on all four sides to represent the Jewish home, that it's open, and that is based upon the idea that Avraham Avinu, maybe Avraham Avinu is based on the idea of the Jewish home, he had a tent that was open on all four sides so he could welcome in guests into his home. And the famous story of three angels that came in the form of humans who came to visit him in his tent. One of them was there to heal him because it was the third day after his Bris Milah. What is this Bris Milah? First of all, what do the words mean? Bris, right? What is that? Number two, why do we need to take a child and remove a piece of skin? Third of all, why from that particular area of the body? And fourth, why do men have to go through this procedure but not Jewish women? What's up with that? I mean, okay, maybe a woman doesn't have that part of the body, but she could, I don't know, take a little bit of the ear off or something, right? Have her ear pierced or something, or cut a nail or something. I don't know. There's other things that could have happened over there. Why is it exclusively a male thing? These questions need to be answered. So some of these answers are almost referred to in the Torah itself. First of all, the Torah says, Vayil os. This Bris Milah is going to be an oath or an os, which means a sign. Brit, see what that is in a second. Beini uvein beneichem, between me and you, says God. So Abraham was commanded that his children and his children's children, all the way down, are going to have this sign put on their bodies. Says the Chofetz Chaim, one of the great Jewish thinkers from before the Second World War, sign is a perfect word. What is a sign? Let's say you walk past a store, and it said outside, Ellie's Bagels. What do I know about this store? It's owned by a guy called Ellie, and it sells bagels. Let's say I go there one day, and it's my usual, I usually get my bagels over there, and I turn up one day, and I see that the doors are closed, and the lights are off, and all the chairs are on the tables. What do I know? The store is closed. After hours, or maybe a Jewish holiday or something. But let's say I turn up a week later, and not only are all the chairs on the tables and the lights off, but the sign outside has been taken down. The sign outside Ellie's Bagels has been removed from outside the store. Now what do I know? What do I know? It's out of business. It's out of business. That's what the Chofetz Chaim says. And there are three mitzvot that have the word ot, sign, attached to them. Number one is tefillin. It's a very important mitzvah. That's why you'll see many people will push that as an important mitzvah. We have Shabbat, it's called an os. And a bris milah is called an os as well. Actually, at any given time, a Jewish male is meant to have two signs on them. So every day a Jewish male puts on tefillin and has the bris milah. When Shabbat comes, they don't need the tefillin because Shabbat takes the place and the bris milah is there. So we always have two signs on us. And what does that mean? That means that these three mitzvot somehow, and we're going to see at least the bris milah one tonight, is so important that if the Jewish people were to take down that sign and remove that mitzvah from our being, we are no longer the Jewish, we're out of business. We are out of business. Which is why there's always going to be people putting on tefillin, there's always going to be people keeping Shabbat, and there's always going to be people doing bris milah. Many other mitzvot have disappeared. All the temple mitzvahs, gone. All the sacrifices, gone. We're still the Jewish people. But these three, they are our shop sign. Once they go, Jewish people are gone. And the Jewish people, we were told from the times of Abraham, could never be gone. We're always going to be there. So that mitzvah is always going to exist. And it's an amazing thing. As I mentioned, you look at the most secular people, will say bris milah. It's weird, right? Of all the things to keep, isn't it easier to, I don't know, keep Shabbat? Right? Hang out, have a meal, you go pray. But here we take an 8-day-old baby. Oh, by the way, another question. Why on the 8th day? And we remove a piece of its skin. And it's I just went through a bris milah myself. I went through a bris milah of my son, although the mitzvah is actually for me. My 8-day-old didn't say, me, bris milah. Who is the mitzvah really for? For the parents. The parents have to do it. Interesting enough, if the parents decide not to, which happens sometimes, not very often, thank God, but sometimes, what happens? An interesting thing occurs. Once that baby reaches 13 years old, the mitzvah transfers from the parents to them. I know a number of people, some of my closest friends actually, came from Russia and Eastern Europe, where having a bris milah was just not done, or outlawed, or in this case, they didn't even know they were Jewish. And the age of 16, 17, 18, they start to have a bris milah. I don't want to talk about it. But what an amazing statement of all the things they got. Now, at that point, you can have an anesthetic, don't worry. But they do it, and that's they're becoming part of the Jewish people. That's the word os. What's bris? So bris actually means a covenant. And doesn't specifically mean the word brit or bris is used elsewhere in Judaism and refers to, says the Maharal of Prague, a permanent connection between two parties. That's what the Maharal says. Whenever you see two parties that make an agreement with each other that has permanence, it's called a brit. You see, Abraham in the Torah made a bris with people. What was going on over there? They made a long-lasting agreement. So too, when you bring your child to have a brit milah, you are making some kind of long-lasting agreement with God. There's some connection that's happening there which would not have happened without a sign on that part of the body. So much so that the Talmud says, how great is a bris milah? You could take all the mitzvot in the Torah, 612 of them, and compare it to bris milah, and bris milah is equal to all of them, which means two things, possibly two things. Now you have scales, on one side you put brit milah, on the other side you put every other mitzvah individually and it weighs up to all of them. Or it means you take all 612, stack them on one side, put brit milah on the other, not that you can physically do that, but you get the idea, and it's equal to all of them. There's something so central to this one mitzvah, to bring that child out. Why would that be? Why is it so special? What is going on? Just removing a piece of skin? What exactly is happening? So one thing we mentioned, there is a certain covenant. So the Talmud tells us that there was a conversation between a great rabbi called Rabbi Akiva and a Roman emperor called Turnus Rufus. And they were having a philosophical discussion. And in the discussion, Turnus Rufus approached Rabbi Akiva and said, whose actions are better? Are God's actions better? Or are human actions better? It's an interesting question. I'm not fully clear exactly what the question was about, but that was the question. Maybe you understand it better than I do. Who's better? God's actions or human's actions? And Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva answered Turnus Rufus and said to him, what kind of question is that? Man's actions are better. And Turnus Rufus said, what are you talking about? Are you saying man is better than God? So Rabbi Akiva turned up with a loaf of bread or a cake, a seven-layer beauty, and said, what's better, this or grains of wheat? And what did Turnus Rufus say? The cake is better than the grains of wheat. He said, so too. We see that God gives us the potential, just like wheat, but you can't just eat wheat. You need to take the potential and you have to make it into greatness. So too, people are born uncircumcised, and then we take that baby and say, I want to make cake out of it. Not literally a cake out of my baby, that's illegal, but I am going to take the raw potential and I'm going to give that sign, that bris between my child and God on that part of the body. That's what the story says. And there's a famous story of King David. He went into a bathhouse. And in the bathhouse, obviously he was naked, right? In the central section where the water was. And he got very depressed. He realized he had no mitzvah. And then he looked down and said, I'm always carrying this sign, this mark on my body that I am a Jew. Let's go a little bit deeper, if you don't mind. He felt bad because he had no mitzvah. He wasn't doing anything, he wasn't giving his tzedakah. At that moment, he was just standing there naked, as it were, and he realized that we have this thing with us all the time. We don't know what it is exactly yet. Had it with the entire time. Let's look at the number 8 for just a moment, because it happens on the 8th day, and that's no coincidence. It happens to be that medically, if you look at it, they realize on the 8th day, a baby has a much better chance of healing it. But why particularly the 8th day? What's up with that? Well, what does the number 8 represent? Well, what do we know about the number 8? It comes after the number 7. So what does number 7 represent? So the number 7 represents this physical world. Okay, there's 7 days of the week. We go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and back to 1 again. 7 days of the week. And by the way, there is no astronomical 7-day cycle. That comes exclusively from the Torah, interestingly enough. Right? There is a 24-hour period, there's a 30-day, and there's a 365, but 7 comes exclusively from the Torah. So 7 represents this world. There are 7 colors in a rainbow, there are 7 notes in a musical scale. Anyone here know music? Do, re, mi, so, fa, la, mi. And goes back to da, na, na. There's no 8th. So what's 8? So 8 is 1 above 7. So if 7 represents the physical world, 8 represents the spiritual realm, the miraculous, the supernatural, the metaphysical, whatever you want to call it. We're dealing with miracles. So for example, we have 8 days of Hanukkah. Okay, and what happened on Hanukkah? Open miracles occurred. So we know that on that day, on that holiday, I'm dealing with the supernatural, and Hanukkah is the ultimate understanding of miracles in this world. So when I go, just for interest, I don't know how it's connected, but in other words, I don't think it was created by the Jewish people, but the number 8 is actually, if you turn it on its side, it's infinity, right? Now, that symbol is not a Jewish symbol, but I believe that it comes originally from this idea that 8 represents the infinite world. Okay, it's that which has no end. It's always there. So I'm dealing with above, what's called in Hebrew, lemala min hateva, above the natural order. So now we see that, and that's going to apply every time you see the number 8 in Judaism. But now we see the Bris Milah happens on the 8th day. So the commentators say something unbelievable. That means when you give your son a Bris Milah on the 8th day, you are admitting that this child is about to enter the Jewish people and does not operate under natural laws. The Jewish people operate at a very high and different spiritual realm than the other nations. Doesn't mean we're better or worse. We may actually reject that mission. But that it is in potential. The Jewish people have a very specific spiritual mission as well. As a nation, and as a nation made up of individuals. So the 8th day is saying that my child is not going to have an ordinary existence of getting up in the morning, going to work, and coming back, and going back to work, and eating, having dinner, watching Monday Night Football, or maybe it's Sunday Night Football now, whatever it is. That's not us. We operate in a different plane, in a different realm. And that's represented by the Bris Milah. I have a lot of notes on this. I'm just going to cut to the main ones. How about a woman? Why is a woman not circumcised? And why does a male have to have it on that part of the body? So here it gets quite interesting. Why that part of the body? There seems to be a connection between a mark and a sign between us and God, and in short, control that we invest into that area of our being. In other words, the fact that that mark and sign could be put anywhere. Could have been that a man took a bit of ear off. The fact that it's put over there means that we, the Jewish people, are admitting to the fact that there is a very strong desire in that realm, and we are going to have to control it and work on it. It's going to be a lifelong struggle, which possibly could be more for male than female, but not necessarily. However, there's going to be areas of perfection that we're going to have to work on that involves the sexual realm. Okay? Check this out. Before Avram Avinu could get into the land of Israel, he had to have a Bris Milah. In other words, if you follow the sequence of events, he had a Bris Milah, and then he went to Eretz Yisrael, to the land. There seems to be a connection between control in this area, right, as in no forbidden sexual relationships, and having a claim to the land of Israel. Rashi says that the land of Israel is like a very sensitive stomach. If you put the wrong food inside a sensitive stomach, whoop, it goes out. And then he says that if forbidden relationships occur in the land, or any sins actually at all occur in the land itself, this is words from the Torah, vomit out its inhabitants. Jew or non-Jew, by the way. I'll say something wild. Happens to be that Muslims also circumcise their sons at the age of 13, because that's when Yishmael, right, Abraham's son through another wife, Hagar, okay, and they also, you can't miss it, also seem to have quite a hold on the land of Israel. You may have noticed that as well. According to some deeper commentators I saw, that could be well connected to the fact that they also, now they're not commanded to have that Bris Milah. Right? They do it optionally. We do it because we have to. So their hold on the land is a temporary hold, as is, because it's the Jewish land. We know that. But to keep in that land, you have to control that area. So before Avram Avinu could go in, he had the Bris Milah. It's as if you don't mind the analogy, but it's as if that was his passport in. That sign, right, is as though I'm saying that I'm part of the Jewish people, I've now entered into a covenant with God, and in order to get in, I'm going to have to work and control that area of my being. And that's the sign that every single Jew, Jewish male, carries with them. So how about women? Why don't they need to? So the Talmud in Avodah Zarah, page 27a, says, Isha kaman demele damya. A woman is considered as though she is circumcised. In other words, if you see circumcision as like, wow, that's an amazing mitzvah, right? No, that's not really what it's there to teach you a lesson and to help you achieve or control a certain area. However, if a person does not have a mitzvah, that means they don't need it. So a woman actually has inbuilt into a system, says the Talmud, this mitzvah, she doesn't need it. Now, interestingly enough, as a mother, she may also be commanded, according to some opinions, to bring her child to a bris milah, so she's kind of fulfilling it that way. But herself, it's not needed. So she doesn't need to put it onto her ear or onto her finger. Says one of the commentators, Rav Tzedek HaKohen, and similarly, about the daughters of Israel, the sages wrote that a woman is considered as if she is circumcised, for even her flesh is considered holy. That's a famous commentator. You don't have the command because you don't need it. We men need it. There's something about man, because men and women are different. I'm sorry to shock you. But we men need that mitzvah in order to achieve what we need to achieve in this world. I read something, an interview a number of years ago by a woman, Esther Kosofsky, and she put it beautifully. Yes, women are viewed differently. Men wear a yarmulke, a skull cap on their heads, as a constant reminder of God's presence. The word yarmulke is made up of two words, yira malka, fear of heaven. Okay, that's why you wear a yarmulke, to show that there's a God above you, or fear of the king. Women don't have to wear one because women have a natural understanding of that concept. They don't need one. It's not that they're worse, heaven forbid. Similarly, circumcision is a physical sign of a bond between man and God. And women, she's basing this upon Rav Tzedek HaGohen and the Talmud. Women don't need a physical reminder that God expects certain things from them because they are born with that spiritual sensitivity inside them already. That's what. And I believe that is very much based upon the Talmudic piece we just read. Okay. So we name a baby girl in the synagogue soon after birth, and the boy is named at the bris milah. That's when he's entering into the covenant, right? The bris, the connection with him and God, right? That part of the body we know, eighth day we know. Okay, and what's happening, that mark is a constant reminder to the Jewish boy, like we said. Women don't need it. She gets called up, her father gets called up, and that's it. And the boy gets to the bris milah because that's when he's entering into the covenant. But what do we name our kids, and how do we name them? And this is also going to be connected. So you see, bris milah is connected to the mission. The idea is to bring children to the world who are going to make the world into a better place. So the first thing we do is to show that you're not perfect when you're born. You're going to have to work on yourself. So the physical reminder on the body is a sign that you need to work on yourself. You weren't born perfect. Fine. Next is the name. Now, Hebrew names are connected to what we're discussing here as well. You see, an English name is very, very different. The names you have don't really mean anything. Your name is Erica. Okay, now when I say Erica, I'm referring to you. But the word Erica doesn't really have any connection to you. It's just the name, just a few letters that we put together. Because if your name was, I don't know, Shirley, like everyone, like a whole bunch of other people, then we didn't know who you're talking to. So everyone gets a name. So there's no connection, can you see this, between a person, Erica, and the name Erica. Are you following? It's just a title we give her. The exact opposite is true in Judaism. Let me explain how and why. The word for a soul in Hebrew is a neshama. Neshama is your soul. Actually, you have five souls. It's your middle soul and probably the most important aspect of your soul, but we'll leave that aside for now. The middle two letters of the word neshama are shame. Shame means name. Somehow encoded in your name is your spiritual character. That means who you are. In your essence is your Hebrew name. Now, a person says to me, but I don't have a Hebrew name. You have one, you may not know it. But you have one. Because if you're born and have a mission in this world, your Hebrew name is there. In other words, your name is like your barcode. Just like you go to a store and there's like lines on the side, and then you take it to the checkout and it goes blip, blip, blip. What comes up on the screen? All the information. So some people have their barcode missing. But that's okay, because the product is still there. They still have essence to them, but the name is just one way of deciphering exactly what your character is. So your name defines who you are. According to Judaism, the deeper sources say that when your parents name you, since your name defines your essence, they don't really give you your name because you can't decide what your kids are going to be. So you have Ruach HaKodesh. There's a certain spiritual influx into a parent at that time when they name their kids. And many times it comes to the mother, and many times it comes to the father, and many times it comes to both. In my family, for some reason, this was my wife. I'd like to tell you a quick story, if I may. We have 7 minutes. This goes from 7:15 to 8 o'clock, so just bear with me. One of my daughters, we had a second daughter, and my wife has dreams. She has certain dreams, whatever, that's her thing. And in a dream, the name came to her, which happened to all the kids, actually. And she came up to me and said, this is the name. And the name was Chaviva. And I'm like, I've never had that name before. Pick a normal name. Sarah. I don't know, Rachel. Well, my first daughter was Rachel. But just pick a name. That's not a Jewish name. I never even heard the name before. She's like, that's the name. I'm like, no, it's not. So what do? When I get into these little discussions with my wife, I call my rabbi. And I called him up. And I said, Rebbe, I'm about to name my daughter this Shabbat. It was Erev Shabbat. And I've got this name. And he said, well, it's very important, number one, that you don't argue with your wife. I'm like, next. He says, it's also very important that whatever your wife wants, you do. I'm like, next. And he says, you can't give your baby a name that embarrasses them in the future. Right? You can't call your child, I don't know, Sunshine Lipstick, or one of these crazy names you hear now, you know, like Rainbow Rising, or, you know, I don't know, some, I don't know, like kids of the 60s, poor things. You shouldn't do that. It's going to embarrass them. So fine. So, whatever. I go home, we have Friday night dinner, I'm actually at my in-laws' home, and I have a custom to sometimes read the Torah, obviously give Divrei Torah, but I did something I've never done before up to that point. I pull the Chumash off the shelf, and I start to read the Torah portion of that week. And what I use, there's an extra mitzvah to read the Aramaic translation of Unklus. A certain convert to Judaism, a very, very holy person, his commentary is considered to be very, very holy, and to read Unklus once, and the Torah portion twice. That's a certain mitzvah that we have. So I'm reading the Torah portion, and it's telling the story of Judah, and he's having an argument with Joseph, not, you know, of he of the technicolor dream coat, and he doesn't know it's Joseph, he thinks he's the prince of Egypt, yada, 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 and he gets into an argument with him, and Joseph says, leave me your son, your brother Benjamin. He says, I can't, because his soul is very much connected to my father's soul, and if I don't return it back home, it's going to be a big trouble. And I looked at the Hebrew, and it said, nefesh kashur b'nefesh, his soul is connected to his soul. And I looked at the unklus, nefesh chaviva b'nefesha. The one time I've seen the word Chaviva appears in the Torah. On that week I was naming my child. I was like, whoa, that's impressive. I'm like, that's impressive. There's other parts to it. Happens to be the baby was born on Hanukkah. And the mitzvah of Hanukkah is the only mitzvah the Rambam describes as Chaviva ad ma'od, which means very, very special. Chaviva means very special. So I said to my wife, you win. I'm down. All right? I'm down with that. So we chose the name. So the name itself comes from a higher place. And by the way, I said to my wife, you're right, that's the name. She's like, yeah, I know, I told you that was the name. She's like, what are you telling me? It's not like I want an argument. That's the name. The name itself is actually given from a higher place, and it defines who that person is. You'll see many people, you may have seen this, go to Hasidic Rebbe's or to Kabbalists, and they'll write down their names. Have you seen this before? And the names of their parents, their fathers, and they give it over, and the person will start telling you about yourself. I mean, I've done it. It's a very freaky thing. He'll be like, I see you have a problem over here. I'm like, ooh, keep your voice down. And he'll actually start listing certain challenges that you have. Right? Purely by looking at your name and the name of your fathers and relatives and anyone else. And they have Ruach HaKodesh. Because your name defines your essence. It's your neshama. And you'll see many times in the Torah, many great people had their names changed. Abraham wasn't always Abraham. He was Avram. After his bris milah became Abraham. And Sarah wasn't always Sarah. She was, anybody know? Sarai, the Torah says. And the yud was taken off. It was actually given to Yoshua, whose name was Hoshua, by the way. Why he got that yud is not for now. And she became Sarah. She got a hey at the end of her name. Now, what does that mean? Just change her name? It was Shirley, it's now Barbara? No. It means the mission in life was different. And many people will get named after a... Well, there's different customs. There's a Sephardim, name after the living. And the Ashkenazim, name after the deceased. Different customs. I think originally the real custom was to name after the they're living. And there's an idea that somehow the soul of that person could well be coming back into that child. I mean, I know many stories. I don't know if you experience this. I know many people are about to give birth or just give birth. And then, heaven forbid, there's like the death of a loved one. Right before a simcha, you see sometimes around that time, I've noticed this. There's like a death of a lover around that time. It's as though the soul of one is being transferred, partly at least, into the other one. Okay? So how do you name a child? So there's different ways to do it. One way to do it is depends on the time of year. Boys who are born around Purim are called Purim boys. Mordechai, not from the story. And girls around Purim who may be called Esther. Or you may have a girl who's born around Hanukkah time. She's called Yehudit. People around Tisha B'Av are called Menachem because we want Hashem to console the Jewish people. So different names are given around different times of the year. There's certain energies that come at that time, and that person impressed something in the world at that time, so they give it that name. Or the name after a loved one or a deceased one. You can't just make it up. Right? There's a custom, for example, in Israel, I've met people who name their boys Nimrod. Now, if anyone's watching this on the internet, or anyone here called Nimrod, now, that's not such a great name for a baby boy, okay? Although Nimrod is called an Ish Gibor, a very strong man in the Torah, he was actually a dictator, right? I mean, you don't want to call your son Saddam, you know what I'm saying, right? Or heaven forbid, Hitler, you know what I'm saying? But you wouldn't just do that, obviously not. So too, Nimrod may not be... I know a certain person, I hope it doesn't mind me saying this, but he had a... Anyway, he changed his name fairly publicly. He had a name... which was of a king, okay? It happens to be a nice name, but his name was Omri, who was a king. Now, I wasn't too familiar with this, but I did his wedding, and he spoke to some great people, and they said that this king wasn't such a great king. Change your name. No, well, who cares? Well, that's his name. Like, no. He changed it to Noach. There's a certain energy you get from your Hebrew name. And many people you'll see, many years later, when they've achieved a lot in life, will look back and say, it's amazing, but my name really has defined who I am. There's another custom when a person is very, very sick, very ill. What do? They will add a name on. Let's say a boy becomes sick, they add the name Chaim or Raphael, right? Raphael is the angel that heals. Or if they're a girl, they'll add Chaya, which means life. Now, what are you doing when you do that? Like, okay, well, let's change the name and everything's going to be great. You're really saying this is not the same person. The person who's ill is David. But this isn't David. This is David Raphael or David Chaim. We're saying that by changing the name, we're inferring we have a different person. There was a custom going back. We don't do it now. If you look at the Rambam, Maimonides actually says that around this time of year, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, people would go through Teshuvah. What is Teshuvah? To repent and become a great person. And what they would actually do is change their names. They weren't ill, but they just wanted to change their life so much, they even changed their names. Now, we do not do that anymore, but historically, that's what people used to do to impress God that this Yom Kippur, I'm not the same. Maybe nowadays, we're just stuck. But in those days, they had that power. Let's recap. So we said there is a mitzvah to bring children to this world, children of how we made the world into greatness. We said that there's a specific mitzvah of parents to bring their child to a covenant, to a bris. That's an oath. That's the sign. The sign goes down, we're out of business. You want to be part of the Jewish business? Got to get a bris milah. That is the covenant. That's what connects us to God. Why that part of the body? That is control. And that gives us the right to control the land of Israel. Not a small thing. Jewish people have been kicked out a number of times. It's never by coincidence. It's always for our actions, spiritually speaking, that it gets us to be kicked out, or hopefully our merits, possibly, that gets us taken back in again. We saw that Ravinu had a bris milah, and through that he was allowed to go to the land of Israel. We all spoke about names, and we said that names represent what the person is. The name is going to define your mission. So we give a child a name through the concept that by giving them this name, they will become representatives of the Jewish people and live up to their names. We're going to stop over there. Any questions on anything we just said? Yes, Erica.
What's the process of when you give a baby a name?
So if it's a girl, the father gets called up to the Torah. If it's a boy, at the bris milah. If you do not have a Hebrew name, you can get your father at any time to go up to the Torah, or you can do a naming ceremony, and if you're called by that name a number of times, that becomes a Hebrew name. The only time Jewishly it makes a difference is on your kesubah, on your marriage document. On your marriage document, you want to have the name. And many times you don't have a Hebrew name, and it'll transliterate your English name. I'll just finish and say that I have an unusual Hebrew name, which I don't go by because it freaks people out a little bit, which is why I go by my name Lawrence, my English name. But I did see a Kabbalist a number of years ago, between you and not be quoted, who said that when I use my name Lawrence, it adds a harshness to my character. I don't know what he was talking about. I'm just telling you what he said. He said, try to go by your Hebrew name. But my Hebrew name is Mashiach, so I don't want to freak people out. Rabbi Mashiach, they'll think I'm like, you know. Yeah, okay. All right. Next week, Rabbi Zalman.